This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello and welcome to the Tuesday edition of Oh God, What Now? On today's show, freedom of movement is finished, but net migration is now more than 500,000. Why does Britain struggle to talk about immigration intelligently? As Tory MPs rebel over housing targets, again, we ask what could really combat NIMBYism. And as artificial intelligence gets better and better at faking images, we talk about how it's going to change our lives and the new risks it brings. Gavin Essler is a journalist and author of How Britain Ends. Hello, Gavin.
Hello. Hi.
The Supreme Court ruled last week that the Scottish Government can't hold a referendum without Westminster's consent. There was a march through your home city, Glasgow, over the weekend. Was this a setback for Nicola Sturgeon, or has it emboldened her?
Well, you know, having read some of the papers in London, it's a terrible thing. It's an awful blunder and so on. I mean, it's just nonsense, I think. You know, I spent the weekend in Edinburgh. Nicola Sturgeon's got lots of problems. The health service, the cost of living crisis. There were demonstrations about, you know, what are we going to do about paying our bills? The ferry system doesn't work. There's problems on the trains, you name it. One thing she doesn't have a problem with, though, is the idea that the Supreme Court in London, quite rightly, it seems, interprets the law that was passed by the Westminster Parliament in London, which says that the Scottish government, the Scottish Parliament, cannot organise a referendum along these lines. Nobody quibbles with that. But what it does is, given that, you know, after the 2014 independence referendum and Brexit happened, which was clearly a material change in circumstances, Alex Salmond wrote a book saying the dream shall never die. And this gives you know, Nicola Sturgeon the option now to run a campaign about these people in Westminster that we, meaning Scotland, didn't vote for. We haven't voted for a Conservative government since 1955. They won't let us leave or even try to leave a voluntary union when they have managed to get us to leave the European Union, because it's a union of democracies. The European Union was happy with that. But somehow Westminster won't let us have our say. So it's perfect for her, frankly. I mean, if there were a referendum, she might actually lose it. If there's not going to be a referendum, there's a sense of grievance. And the Scottish word is thrawn. I'm quite thrawn. That means stubborn, sometimes beyond my own best interests. And this will just go on and on and on. But the idea that it's a terrible own goal from Nicola Sturgeon, I'm afraid I don't buy.
Hannah Fern is a columnist for The Independent. Hello, Hannah.
Hi.
The head of the Bright Blue think tank stood down this week, saying the Tories had abandoned millennials. I mean, he's got a point, clearly, but have older Tories noticed?
Well, they have, but there was a lot of mocking and sort of sarcasm on social media about this from both the left and the right. Oh, wasn't this a terrible great loss of a, you know, a great mind, ha-ha, suggesting that he really didn't add very much to the political debate on the right and, you know, good riddance. I think that's overlooking the point, which is that I think he's about 38 years old. He's an older millennial. He feels very strongly and gave an exit interview to The Guardian about how angry he is about the Tories' failure to understand the issues that face that generation, whether that's the cost of childcare, housing, which we'll talk about later. And he and his think tank, which was established in 2014, spoke very eloquently, frankly, on those issues. They came up with policy alternatives that were roundly ignored once the Cameron era was over. His organisation were very much Cameronite. They were of that sort of generation of what looked like potentially progressive conservatism, although, you know, you may argue whether it was or not, but that's where they fitted in. He's stepping back. He's probably quite right to think about his own future. He clearly doesn't fit in with current parliamentary conservatism. But where does this leave the Tories if people like this are fleeing? We've also seen the departure of Chloe Smith and a couple of other MPs saying they're not going to stand at the next election. I think Tories should be really worried about this. I saw, interestingly, an op-ed in the Telegraph today, which was sort of a very shouty, angry thing about socialism in schools creating a kind of extremely left-wing generation of children. It smacks to me of panic, really. They know there's a large generation of voters who really can't see anything in conservatism that benefits them. And where's the next generation coming through to the party as well? MPs, policy thinkers, not really there.
Yeah, Ryan is no fool, and he could have been the future once for the Tories, but evidently not yet. Nina Schick is a journalist and online misinformation expert, author of Deep Fakes and The Infocalypse. Hi, Nina.
Hi, Ross. Great to be back.
It is. It's great to have you back. It's been a while since you've been on, isn't it?
I know. Yeah. What's been going on?
Oh, nothing much. No. You missed nothing.
Quiet summer, right?
Last weekend, Elon Musk locked most of his Twitter employees out of their offices, unbanned Donald Trump, and thousands of users were sharing their profiles on other sites, thinking this would be the end. But a week later, Twitter endures. How long do you give it?
You know what? I actually think it's going to endure. It's maybe not like the conventional wisdom right now. When you're looking at the antics from, you know, Donald Trump being invited back onto the platform to the fact that it's now going to become a new hub again for QAnon and all the other nonsense that seems to be taking place. But I think that Musk is going to will it to survive. And the kind of changes that he's got in the pipeline mean that this platform is going to be very different from what we've seen before. But I don't think it's over for Twitter yet.
Before we get started, an Oh God, What Now public service announcement. Our online Christmas market is open now for all your festive gifting needs with 15% off for Black Friday, which I think is now past, but it's still 15% off, so take advantage. Just go to podmarket.co.uk for a range of quality presents from Oh God, What Now and our companion podcasts, The Bunker and Doomsday Watch. Get the conversation rolling on Christmas morning with a woke snowflake t-shirt or mug for your favourite Brexity uncle. Festoon the kitchen with the Ho 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 God What Now Christmas tea towel. Or even a Doomsday Watch tea towel, if you fancy one, just to mop up those oil spills. And remember the golden moments of 2022 with the tofu-eating Wokarati and Anti-Growth Coalition mugs. There's something for everyone at podmarket.co.uk. Order now for delivery in time for Christmas. Thousands of people in China took to the streets at the weekend to protest against its zero COVID policy. The Chinese leadership won't unlock because it has less effective vaccines than the rest of the world, and it hasn't persuaded enough of its elderly people to take the jab. Gavin, people have been calling for Xi Jinping to resign. This is unprecedented, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is quite extraordinary. I was there in the beginning of the Tiananmen Square demonstrations many years ago, which is the only kind of parallel, although I don't think they would go in similar ways. And what was very interesting then was the students, I was just there at the start. I wasn't, fortunately for me, not there at the end when the killings took place. But the students were talking about democracy. And what they were really talking about, when you ask them what is democracy, they understood that we in the West were somehow richer than them. And the other bits, they weren't that bothered with. And Deng Xiaoping, the leader at the time, was ruthless in the end in putting them down. But he did figure out that the way forward for China was to be richer and people would be content, which is what has happened. But Xi now has a whole series of problems, obviously. If people's lives are disrupted, they can't get food, they can't get food for their kids, they can't get to work. This is disrupting the unspoken social contract that was begun by Deng Xiaoping all those years ago. And Xi has also got the foreign policy problems, which he's associated with Russia, which is the fading light that is Putin. So even though he appears to be completely politically secure, the discontent in the cities in particular is something which will be very worrying. And one other thing I would say, I mean, I'm no China expert, but the China experts I've talked to says, watch out when there are demonstrations, they go on for a bit in China, and then the authorities don't just send in the riot police and others, they send in the soup kitchens and they give people noodles, and that's a sign that you better go home, otherwise you might get shot. I'm not quite sure where we are on that or whether Xi fits into that rather cynical pattern, but it's going to be a period of great difficulty for a lot of people, it seems.
A BBC journalist was arrested and beaten by the police after filming the protests. Do you think this is going to affect British policy towards China? Because Rishi Sunak is giving a speech on just that subject soon after we're recording.
Well, it will be very interesting to see what Mr. Sunak has to say about that. I mean, look, we have had this delusion about global Britain and sending an aircraft carrier to the Pacific and all this kind of stuff. We've also seen what the practicalities of that are, that China can do what it wishes to do in Hong Kong. And despite the fact for many years it was a British colony, there's not much we can do about it. So Britain is a trading partner. Britain is of interest. But there are many, many bigger players, obviously, including the United States in this. So I'm not sure whether Rishi Sunak's words, whatever they may be, will carry a lot of weight, frankly, with Xi Jinping.
China's repression in Hong Kong is one of the reasons why net migration to the UK has exceeded 500,000 over the past year, according to the Office for National Statistics. Many Hong Kongers are entitled to come and live and work in the UK because Hong Kong, of course, used to be a British colony. While migration from the EU has slowed down because of Brexit, resettlement schemes for Hong Kongers, Ukrainians and Afghans have boosted the numbers, plus a bounce back after the halt to movement during the pandemic. But as the treatment of Ukrainians and Afghans shows, it's one thing to take people in, it's another to look after them properly. So why are these systems failing and why can't politicians talk about it in a clear-eyed way? Hannah, let's talk about the small boats. The migrants who arrive on them are usually sent to a centre in Manston in Kent. And the Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, was asked about why it had become so overcrowded at a committee hearing last week. It wasn't her best performance. What was her defence?
No, it wasn't. And if you want to go back and have a look at that performance, look at the recording, you can see the faces on the members of the committee as they're questioning her, listening to her responses. And don't forget, that's a cross-party committee. And the looks at her responses really tells the story. Her defence was simply to blame asylum seekers for coming over in the first place and blamed the forces that pushed them towards us and blamed anybody who felt, as she said, was moved to abuse the generosity of the British people. So almost blaming us for being too understanding of those who need or potentially want to claim asylum here. She also refused to accept her legal responsibility for ensuring that Manson operated properly. We know that she had received legal advice warning her that this overcrowding situation was at risk of occurring and then was indeed occurring, and in detail about the risks of that. So, you know, the health risks. One person has since died of diphtheria who was there, and the conditions are described in squalid terms. So, yes, she absolutely refused to accept any responsibility for this. Another amusing moment, if you want to try and find some light relief in this, was her staggering failure to come up with an answer to a question about the legal routes of passage here. So there was a really strong question about what would you do if you were someone who was perhaps a young East African boy who had 16, who had relatives already over here, had every legal right to claim asylum and stay with those relatives to escape war, conflict. Fundamentally, because she couldn't answer the question because there is no legal right of passage. That person would have to face the small boat's route to come here. And that's clearly morally wrong. And her blustering and embarrassment around it simply exposed that. So, yes, not a good day for the Home Secretary, but useful for all of us for understanding the problem, really.
Manston is now empty. Where have the 4,000 migrants, massively more than the 1,600 that it was supposed to house, who were there? Where have they gone?
Well, they've been moved into hotels all around the country. This is an interesting one for a number of reasons. First of all, I think it really is distressing in the echo of the situation with the care homes crisis in COVID. We know that a large number of these refugees, asylum seekers, potentially did have diphtheria. It was passing through the community there. And they've been, without any testing, they've been sent out to hotels housing refugees all across the country. That only came out because of some excellent reporting by a former colleague of mine, Sean Linton, at the Sunday Times. I expect the government wished that was he hadn't picked up on that one on such a busy brief at the moment. But yeah, I mean, shocking. Have they learned nothing from what happened in COVID? And the result of that, we wait to see. It's only a few days later. The other interesting thing about the use of these hotels is it's a kind of classic, the word hotel sparks a very emotional response. You know, if you're someone who's really struggling with the cost of living now, maybe you're struggling on the social housing waiting list, and you hear that somebody who may or may not actually have the right to be here is being housed in a hotel, that gives you a really kind of emotive response because it feels like they're being put up in luxury. Actually, these hotels and the lives that people live within them are astonishingly bad. Very, very unsuitable accommodation, whole families in single rooms. And the people who are staying there, particularly the Afghan, I spoke to Afghan refugees staying in hotels in London and in Southampton earlier this year. And their lives are completely controlled by life in that hotel. They can't have visitors. They can't choose what they eat, even. They have to eat at set times and given the food that they're provided. They have no control over their environment. They can't talk to anyone. They're not allowed to talk to anybody about these conditions. They have all kinds of and work restrictions placed on them as well. And so it's hard to imagine how depressing that life is and how it actually entrenches dependence. So certainly people who left Afghanistan, they came here wanting to work, wanting to build a new life, but this hotel system doesn't work for them. So I can't see that this is a great resolution to the crisis there. Now, we did have a processing centre that maybe 5 months ago was working pretty well. Now it's empty, unnecessarily, and
The number of Albanians crossing the channel this way has increased a lot in the last year. What do we know about why they're trying to come to the UK?
Yes, the figures are quite astonishing. In 2020, 50 migrants from Albania crossed. And the figure from the first nine months of 2022 was 11,241. So that's a staggering rise. The kind of pressures that are pushing them here are, you know, corruption, political corruption, extreme poverty, poor wages, really high rates of youth unemployment, which obviously means you've got a large number of young men who really want a better life for themselves. And actually, there's an incredibly aggressive gang culture, frankly, which is using social media to attract people into what basically selling honest work and actually attracting people into criminality, saying that there's a better life for them with genuine opportunities, and then they get unfortunately trapped in these cycles of exploitation. So this is a really interesting and difficult one to talk about. We have to be honest about the criminality involved there. We have to be honest about the fact that large number of these people are young men who actually don't have the right to claim asylum here, and when they get here, they probably will be sent back. And the government has actually moved to set up a kind of rapid process to ensure that those who would not be able to claim asylum are sent back. But those who are accepted, the vast majority of people who have been accepted in their claim from Albania since 2020 are trafficked women and their children. So the system is working in that sense. And so we mustn't be derailed by this idea that some politicians would like to capitalise on, that you know, the system isn't working because there are a large number of able-bodied single men, young men, coming over. Actually, they're not staying. The people who are staying are those women who've been abused.
Gavin, the government reacted to the 500,000 figure for net migration by announcing a crackdown on foreign students doing what it calls low-quality courses. What would a cut in numbers mean for universities?
I'll come to universities in a moment. What would it mean for the country? You know, we used to witter on endlessly about a brain drain because bright British people were going abroad to study. And suddenly we have a brain gain because all these people are coming here to study. I mean, it's St Andrews University, 39% of the students are international students. And St Andrews is reckoned to be one of the greatest universities anywhere in the world. In Kent, where I am, it's 16%. It's about 20% a lot of students. So it's not just that universities would lose some money, but they would. But we would lose some of the most talented people in the world who actually think Britain's quite a good place to study. And it's also our soft power. You know, the universities of Britain are, from Aberdeen in the north right down to the south of England, highly regarded around the world, not just because we teach in English, but because we've got so many experts. So what we have is this really uninformed, quite idiotic debate about migrants and about university students and about people who overstay their visas and so on. There are ways of sorting it out, but they're not, I mean, the best this government has come up with is we will send them to Rwanda, which is precisely the kind of country in Africa that the Conservative MP who was questioning Suella Braverman about people who are oppressed coming here, how what would be the legal route, that's precisely the kind of country he could have been referring to. So, you know, we are unable, it would appear, to have a grown-up conversation about this because it gets us into very uncomfortable areas, which could include, for example, the use of identity cards before you can actually get employment and other things. I mean, and also, of course, having proper relations with the rest of the European Union, without whom some of this nonsense about pushing back migrants in the channel and all that just is that. It's vacuous.
Ending freedom of movement from leaving the EU was supposed to bring down overall migration. Of course, it hasn't. But there is an argument on parts of the left that it's fairer not to privilege Europeans in immigration policy. And I hear this occasionally from especially people on the, shall we say, more Corbynite left. What's your take on that?
Well, I'm not sure quite who is privileged at all, really, by our immigration system. I can't think of very many people who are. And there have been such uncertainties about it. I mean, it's to put it another way, it is obvious that people from neighbouring countries are more likely to move here than people from the other side of the world, simply because it's closer. Why did we have lots of Irish immigrants in the turn of the 19th to 20th centuries? Because Ireland was relatively poor and people could come here. So whereas we didn't have many Korean or Japanese migrants. Well, now it's slightly different. But I have to say that the sort of welcoming of Britain, or particularly England, the hostile environment to people that Theresa May announced without actually doing anything about it, the idea that we were going to have somehow miraculously 100,000 net migrants a year, David Cameron talked about. June 2022, it's about 500,000. We just don't have a coherent policy because we're not really prepared to face up to some of the rather hard decisions about how to do this. And they involve, as I say, relations with Europe, and they may involve having, if you've got people who come here and who can get a job, and all HMRC cares about is do they pay their taxes? They don't care if they're here legally. That's another department. We do have a kind of systemic problem, which we haven't really thought through.
Nina, are we a more welcoming country than the right-wing press and the Conservative Party like to pretend, do you think?
I mean, when it comes to immigration or migration policy, it's just such a huge mess, as Gavin and Hannah have already pointed out. And the fundamental reason is because we've never had a honest conversation, right? Even in the early days of Brexit, when the campaign was getting started, we were all holding our head in our hands because there was the willful conflation of illegal and legal migration, EU migration, asylum seekers, illegal economic migrants, and that has just continued. And now we're just careening from reactive policy to reactive policy, whether it's the tens of thousands headline figure, which now successive conservative governments have had, and it seems like net migration now is higher than ever before, or whether it's like, now we shall tackle the international students, they're the problem. Oh, it's Macron, he's sending the boats over. And it's just so intellectually dishonest, and it's such a disservice to this country, because, I mean, I'm an immigrant, I've naturalized here now, and although, of course, I've also encountered the really horrific parts of the UK migration and border system, including my Nepali cousin who had a valid visa here, like being turned away and then deported at Heathrow Airport just because they didn't like the look of her. I've experienced that side of it, but I've also experienced the fact that Britain can also be a very open and welcoming nation. And I don't think that it is a country of bigots. And I do think that the sense of having a fair system really does matter to the British citizens. And you see that, of course, in the kind of demographic makeup of Britain as a country. You know, this is a country that has had a lot of inward migration for many decades now. So I just think this kind of intellectual dishonesty, which you see just continuing decade after decade, is just so frustrating because it's not beyond us to have a better conversation about how to deal with immigration. And well, it's not beyond us, one would think, but apparently it is.
And Hannah, I mean, Keir Starmer on, as well, is treading a fine line on immigration. He gave a speech last week saying British companies needed to cut their dependency on foreign workers. Does he convince you in what he said about it?
No, I feel that he's got caught up in this rhetoric. Exactly as Nina described, I think as a country are much more fair in our attitudes, but we are given this kind of political cycle of intellectually weak arguments that don't help people have a proper conversation. Exactly as you've said. So I think Starmer's falling on the wrong side of it. I think we are much more understanding, perhaps for a couple of reasons. We're kind of more sympathetic to the push factors now, reasons why they may need to be here, especially with Ukraine. I think we understand what's going on in the world, and we are sympathetic. I also think that post-Brexit, there's a kind of greater understanding of how much we rely on foreign labour. You hear people talking about, you know, the nurses being the jewel in the crown of the NHS and so on. How many of our NHS nurses were not born in the UK? A huge number, huge percentage, and people completely understand and respect and value their contribution to, you know, British society. So, I mean, and just actually anecdotally, my own experience, and I live in South London, my daughter's primary school has had 60 families join the school community since June. That's a huge number. But the response has been overwhelmingly positive and hugely supportive. And the effort that, you know, families within the school have put into welcoming and providing for those people has been great, and also really reassuring that actually we don't live among a sea of bigotry that some of our politicians almost willing on us. So I think Starmer has got it wrong, actually. And I know he was trying to address businesses and not kind of, you know, your general voter, but still perhaps misunderstanding how much businesses know they rely on foreign labour and want to continue to do so, because it's a model that's working.
And yet, Gavin, from most of the British media, you wouldn't guess that there was, or wouldn't know that there was, that generosity of spirit. Why are we so bad at covering this? I mean, 9.5 million of us in Britain weren't born in this country. And yet the voice of immigrants is so quiet. Well, I wouldn't say quiet, so small in this country.
The Esslers were 17th century Protestant migrants from Germany who joined with the Scottish army because they were being persecuted in Bavaria during the 30 Years' War. You know, so I don't really remember that myself, but I'm on the same page. I would say one thing, though. This generosity of spirit, it does infect. You began with talking about my native city, Glasgow. In Glasgow, they are welcoming of immigrants. Not everybody. I mean, there are racists and bigots and all kinds of people everywhere. But if you're a Glaswegian, you're a Ouija. You call me. That's what you're called. If you're a refugee, you're a refugee. You're one of us. Not for everybody. I'm not, you know, glossing over it. But when the Home Office, which again is from London, is not the Scottish Home Office, tried to get rid of some people from South Glasgow, I think it was, the south side, local people just laid under the vans and said, you're not taking them, they're our neighbours. Now, maybe that was right or wrong, I don't know the circumstances of this, but all I'm saying is that the welcome is there. The media reporting of it, however, is that there's this wedge of, you know, terrible people who are coming over here to do terrible things, apparently, like work in the NHS, for example, or do the jobs that the rest of us won't do. So I think we could clean up our act a bit. But again, the standard of political debate is such that many of us who are journalists have to take our cue from that, even though we have to also understand that that's not how many people may feel.
You might think this government isn't that keen on house building, but for some Tory MPs, the push to build has gone quite far enough. They want to scrap compulsory housing targets for councils in the Levelling Up Bill, making those targets advisory only. This is an issue that's actually splitting the right. One think tank director, Robert Colville, said making the targets voluntary would enshrine NIMBYism as the governing principle of British society. He said it was selfish. Hannah, you've written recently about downsizing, when elderly people sell the family home and move into a smaller place. And it's not happening very much, is it?
No, it's not happening, and it hasn't done for maybe two decades. Everyone talks about it as kind of a great solution to some of the pressures in the housing market, partly because, it genuinely releases numbers. So if people start moving around, there's more housing stock available, and that makes the market move a bit more. And partly because, not to put too fine a point on it, is a form of bed blocking, basically bedroom blocking. If you've got two people living in a 5 or 6 bedroom family home, what's happening to the family who 3 or 4 decades ago would have moved into that house? They are stuck in a 2-bedroom house or a 3-bedroom house, incredibly overcrowded. So, and this actually happens in social housing too. There are people who are in the social housing sector, housing policy experts, who've worked very hard on trying to create a kind of moving market within social housing so that tenants can move around as their family circumstances change. And again, even within that, even where you'd think that councils and housing associations actually have some levers, it's really hard to move people around. And it's partly to do with attitudes. People just don't want to move, especially as they're getting older. But it's really short-sighted, and there's a lot of evidence to show that the earlier that you move into a very appropriate home for later years, the less chance you are likely to have any kind of ill health that speeds up, physical decline, so a fall, those kind of things. And there are so many positive reasons, but people don't want to do it. I spoke to my own parents about it. They didn't want to do it. They bought a larger home after I'd left home. So it's a really difficult cultural problem, and we do need to find a way through it.
In recent years, lots of people have been encouraged to go for shared ownership if they can't afford to buy. But there's a downside to that, isn't there?
Oh, my God, this is my pet hate. So I've been covering housing issues for quite a long time. My first job in my career was on a very specialist magazine called Inside Housing. And shared ownership was this great sort of wheeze from the social housing sector, designed to kind of force themselves really into the property developments to find new ways to fund social housing. So they also thought there is a form of housing need, which is people who are in good jobs, but who simply can't afford rising prices, will maybe never afford to buy on the open market, but they can certainly sustain a regular small mortgage payment. So there are really good reasons in theory for setting it up. The problem is it's a massive trap, and I'm a huge cynic about it. And the way the social housing sector has used it as simply a cash cow for their social housing business, where the government has stepped back instead of really continuing to put extra pressure on the government to properly fund social housing, I think is morally problematic. We're moving into an era where people who are already in shared ownership are going to be in crisis. Their rent is rising. So if you are in shared ownership, you pay mortgage on the percentage you own, you pay rent on the percentage you don't own. And often you also pay a service charge because you're in a block of flats maybe. So your outgoings are significant, not really comparable. It's actually really probably more expensive overall than if you could actually get the deposit together for ownership independently. If your mortgage is going up, we've all seen the situation with mortgage rates at the moment. If you've also got your rent going up and you're trapped in a building which is hit by the cladding scandal, so you can't sell, you're in dire straits at the moment. And these are often vulnerable families who, should really have qualified for social housing in previous generations, but don't under current housing need standards. And it's a small demographic, but one that government and housing has failed. And in my view, if you're thinking about shared ownership, don't do it.
Gavin, let's talk about NIMBYism. John Harris wrote a nuanced piece in The Guardian last weekend. He argued that you're going to struggle to get communities to accept new housing unless they're promised more transport, GPs and schools too, because they will argue there simply aren't enough facilities for people moving in. Do these people sometimes have a point?
Yes, in brief they do, and certainly I know it from friends. Pressure on schools, for example, more people move in they feel that the teachers can't cope, and where do the GPs come from? Where do the people that we all rely on? I would say one counter to Hannah's argument, I do know of a couple who I try not to identify them, but they hit about the age of 60 and they decided to downsize to a 2-bedroom flat in the center of London. And I said, why are you doing it? And they said, because our kids are finishing university and they might want to move home back to our house. So you can see it in different ways. But the NIMBYism point is a good one. I also know I've got a friend who's been very active in the environmental movement and so on. And he's come to the view that there are certain house builders who can be persuaded to improve things, to put aside a bit of land for a bit of wild space, who can have, you know, bird boxes in their homes, who can build a bit differently. But he's run up against a couple of things. One is straightforward NIMBYism. We don't like new houses, period. We don't care what they look like. And also land banking, the speculation on land that we should just sit on and eventually will develop. So it's a very, very complex problem. And I'm not sure, I think the divisions within the Conservative Party itself and within show just how complicated this is going to be to sort out.
Nina, we hear more and more about an intergenerational divide in British politics. Is this the big thing that's feeding it?
There absolutely has to be some kind of, I mean, I'm not going to profess to be an expert in the UK housing market or even in the intergenerational divide in politics, but there is something rotten in the state of Denmark when most young people just can't, you know, including a working couple of professionals, cannot afford to buy their own home. My own observations, kind of as somebody who's been living here for a while, but who originally is a foreigner, is that one thing that's really unique is this cultural expectation of home ownership as a benchmark, right? Everybody's aspiring to own their own home, which is certainly not the case in other European countries. And that must be tied to the fact that you have very weak rights as a tenant, right? That's the first thing. And then secondly, there's still this expectation that your home is where you make your money, that that's where you invest your money in order to see it accrue, to see your wealth accrue over the decades. Now, that might have been true for the baby boomers, but I don't know if that is true for today's generation. Nonetheless, that expectation still seems to be prevalent. So people would rather invest their money in a home than, let's say, on the stock market. The second thing I've observed over countless conversations over British dinner tables, including in my own British family, is the kind of hackneyed stereotype of millennials eating avocados and not saving up for their deposit, you know, and their parents, they lived in a shoebox and they were rationing and, you know, they worked really hard. Therefore, they deserve the wealth that they accrued in their property that they bought for 50,000, which is now worth 3 million. That seems to be pretty ingrained. So I think it seems that for millennials, there is an uphill struggle to say, yes, you know, we can have cheap holidays to Spain. And yes, we can buy a lot more clothes and have flashy tablets and big screen TVs. But no, we cannot afford to buy a home. So the fact that we can have different kind of luxuries, which were, you know, not available to the boomers, doesn't seem to, you know, when it comes to home ownership, that obviously I'd rather be able to buy a home than have a cheap holiday in Spain. And then the third and fourth observations are like, you cannot, absolutely not in the Southwest, you cannot dream of getting on the housing ladder unless you have a significant liquidity moment. Let's say you're a very successful entrepreneur, you sell your business, or you have family wealth. I mean, there is absolutely no way you're getting on the housing ladder otherwise, because the prices are just so insane. And without significant firepower, it's just not happening. And this argument that, well, you could buy a house if you go to the Outer Hebrides, I mean, like, that's just not going to work, right? It depends on where you're working and other things like schools for your kids, etc. And the final point I want to make, because this is just such a bugbear for me, is the quality of the homes. And Hannah, you will probably have a good understanding of this, but like insulation. Why are British homes not insulated? It's like the bane of my life when, you know, you kind of go into a beautiful British home and you sleep in a sleeping bag because it's so cold, you know? And obviously this is now coming to the forefront with the energy crisis. But again, this is, I suppose, because our winters are milder than they are in continental Europe, where, you know, buildings, old buildings, for instance, in Germany, they'll have been built with double glazing, even at the turn of the century, not so in the UK. And I suppose also with successive developments in the 60s and onwards, I think Hannah will know, but it's that I think the building regulations are way more lax, right? So
we have terrible, terrible housing standards even now. And one of the worst failures of the last 20 years is knowing the energy crisis is coming, knowing where we are with, you know, situation around climate change, the absolute failure of the, you know, of government and developers to insist on better standards and retrofitting, on installing solar and so on, has been astonishing, really. And you know, there was about 15 years ago there was a big push on it, but with everything that happened post 2008, it just got lost. And it's depressing, especially when a lot of these issues around standards, it's we've seen it with the situation with mold and ventilation, with the death, tragic death of that poor two-year-old boy. You know, a lot of the time this is social housing we're talking about, and housing provided to the neediest people with the worst standards.
Yeah, I mean, insulation is bad, and ventilation is bad as well, because and often it's a trade-off between, you know, if you get the fresh air, the cold comes in, and if you don't, you grow mold, and it's this catch-22 I find in my house, and I'm lucky enough to live in a house we own, but it's still a struggle to overcome those problems. Hannah, is there anything the government can do to encourage councils to want to allow more houses?
I think I struggle slightly with this idea of like kind of blaming councils, because they are, there's the pressures of the NIMBYism that you're describing. I have to say Robert Colville and I do not agree on very much, but we very fundamentally agree on housing issues. That he's right that you know, you've just got, there's got, something's got to be done. Councils do want to build. They understand the kind of social benefits, the economic benefits of development in their area. It's the red tape around development that the government puts in place, and the NIMBYism that's causing all of these problems. And I think if you free up local government to operate in a way that it believes is right for its area, you'll get better results, actually, than this kind of over-interventionist policy that we're seeing at the moment.
Artificial intelligence can do a lot of things, and one of them is to generate images. There are various websites that can turn text into auto-generated pictures. For example, you could type in Ian Dunt preparing a Doritos lasagna the size of Wembley Stadium. I tried Rishi Sunak cooking a ready meal in a microwave in a tiny flat, and the result did leave something to be desired. I'll post that one on my Twitter feed for everyone to admire. Fortunately, Nina is an expert on deepfakes and AI, and if you follow her, you'll see just how good the technology has become. Nina, you've predicted that 90% of all online content could be AI generated by 2025 or 2030. How can that be possible?
Well, it's absolutely mind-blowing, but I think we are entering a new era in human communication, even human evolution, given that our primary medium of communication is now the digital sphere. And this is happening at precisely the time when you are seeing the emergence of these AI models that can not just generate, it's not only pictures they can generate, but they can generate anything that we've thus far considered to be unique to human creativity or intelligence. So, for instance, you can now have these large generative models where you put in a text, type in what you want, and it can generate a unique image of that. But it's not only for images. It can do the same for video, where you type in a video sequence that you want, and it can generate a video. It can do the same for copy. There are already generative models out there, and in fact, AI generative AI companies, where you can just generate a script to a play, a copy for marketing, a blog, just on a few prompts, say what you want, and then the AI will generate it for you. And given that these models are now reaching the rate of exponential acceleration, you're going to be able to see them scale. And these models have only really come to the fore in the last 6 months, and you're already seeing millions of people playing with them, billions of pieces of content being produced, and you're going to basically think, I think in the next few years, the amount of AI generated content is going to far outweigh anything that's not generated by AI, 90% in my estimation.
I've been thinking about this for the book I'm finishing at the moment, and I was trying to imagine a scenario when the Queen in a video, deepfake video, emerged of the Queen after her death, saying something rather unexpected. And it was a fascinating scenario to imagine, because I think we can be surprisingly credulous when it comes to deepfakes and our willingness to believe them. In your book, you discuss deepfake porn. And the online safety bill is now going to make that a crime. Are you relieved about that?
Absolutely. That's low-hanging fruit, and well done to the UK for being one of the first countries in the world to take leadership in terms of criminalizing AI-generated non-consensual pornography. Because in order to create this, and by the way, the women are the victims are 99.9% women, and it's not only female celebrities who are targeted, but normal everyday women, including minors, because all that you need to put someone in AI generated fake porn is a little bit of training data. So that is images of them from their social media, perhaps a video of them that you can easily scrape over social media. So everyone is potentially a victim. So this is very low hanging fruit in terms of, yeah, this is bad. Let's criminalize it. What's really interesting is that I came to this area and I wrote the book Deep Fakes because I had my disinformation background and I was looking at it from the perspective of mis and disinformation. And it started in porn because porn is so pioneering. And since my book has come out, I've realized that this is actually far more profound than just the ability to create sophisticated disinformation with the use of AI. But that this is going to be one of the biggest turning points in human communication, because all content, everything, whether it is a legal text, a Hollywood film, a blog post, a podcast, can now be generated by artificial intelligence. So that's just going to completely transform the way we communicate, the way we do commerce, and the way that we understand the world.
A podcast, so we could have fake Oh God, What Now?
It's worth playing. I mean, do you guys actually play with any of the AI podcast editing tools? Descript, for instance, where you can take our tracks, you can drop them into Descript, and then you can edit the track as though you're editing a Word doc.
You know, I think we should try to do that just for this podcast and see what it comes out with.
Yeah,
no, I mean, this is already happening. Bloomberg has been running an AI section of stories for a while now. So they no longer use journalists to produce their stories about market moves. That's all done by AI. So
right.
That terrifies me. Getting out of a job soon.
the copy generation is unbelievable. And there's a new model coming out probably in December this year. It's called GPT-4, which is a model that's essentially been trained on the corpus of every single text that's ever been produced by humanity. So it's not only that you can ask it to generate a article about the broken housing system in the UK, you can also ask it to write a sonnet in the style of Shakespeare. So AI can not only learn to produce coherent output when prompted with a task, but it can actually distinguish distinct styles as well, which is just obviously mind-blowing.
Hannah, as you say, this is bad news for a lot of journalists, and certainly it's bad news for photographers and artists over the next few years. What does this mean for them?
It's really hard to say. I mean, you know, Nina's expressed where we are really profoundly. You know, it's a turning point. Thinking about journalism, you know, it does raise these questions of ethics. You know, photo editors and so on, part of their job is to interpret where we are, if that, you know, and a huge part of their job is going to be interpreting truth and fake, or truth and not truth, however we want to express that. I also think it raises these questions about access to information and gatekeepers. At the moment, there's a lot of chat online about who, like, gatekeeping as this terrible thing, that there are people in positions of power, often editors, journalists, people like me, who interpret information, and in doing that we're acting as some kind of filter and gatekeeper, and that's a negative thing, because perhaps we're putting our own prejudices and our own privileges into play when we're doing that. And actually I think this kind of discussion raises the question of how significantly important gatekeepers are around managing the flow of truth as well. So, I mean, this is a huge philosophical area, and I can't say that I feel vastly sort of prepared in terms of, my view on that right now. But I can feel how significant this is. It's a turning point for everyone who works in information and copy and content as their job. We have responsibilities as well. It's fascinating as well.
Gavin, who's going to do the job of working out what's fake and what's real? Could we entrust it to the BBC, for example?
When I was listening to Hannah talking there, I was thinking that we have enough problems as journalists with shallow fakes like Boris Johnson and Donald Trump. So if we can't actually sort out and constantly say, do you know what, they've normalized lying in our public life and this is a problem and that's a lie and that's a lie. The Washington Post did a great job with Trump saying in the end there were 30,000 lies he told during his presidency. But that is really difficult. So if we can't do that, how we handle deep fakes, which as Nina described eloquently, I mean, I have no idea whether maybe we're all fake. There's a really serious point here as well. I mean, not just the horrors of pornography and people having their reputations ruined by other people thinking they've done or said things that they haven't. Going back in history, one of my favorite European philosophers was Hannah Arendt, who said that what makes people seek out strong leaders, essentially, is not knowing the difference between truth and falsehood, not being able to tell what is fact and what is real and what is not. And that this has profound consequences because we're already getting it with people saying all politicians are the same, they all lie. Well, they don't all lie, actually, and they don't all lie in the same way as Trump has. So we have got a real problem as journalists, but also as the rest of our culture, it seems to me.
Nina, how else is AI going to affect life in the next few years on a sort of practical level?
Well, I think very broadly, we've entered an era of exponential tech-led change that's powered by AI. And generative AI is only one application of that. You already see how multiple advances in artificial intelligence are unfolding in different fields, whether it's predictions or even like very positive advances in the fields of science and medicine. And I think that our lifetime, we will experience in one lifetime more tech-led change than the entirety of humanity has experienced before us. So this next few decades are going to be one of flux, of turmoil, of change. It's going to get very tumultuous, but there's a lot of opportunities as well as risks. And I've been reflecting on perhaps why you see so much political turmoil. And I truly believe that one reason we see so much global political turmoil is because the kind of analog systems of the past or the kind of ways we structured our society are no longer fit for purpose when it comes to the challenges we have to deal with in the 21st century, whether that's climate change or indeed the immense societal changes that are going to be brought onto us by technology, including artificial intelligence. I think the world in 30 years from now, some of it is going to look very similar, but so much of the fundamental structure will have changed beyond our comprehension.
Before we go, it's time for our panelists to tell us their escape routes. What have you enjoyed recently that isn't political? Or it can be political if you only do political stuff like I do, because I'm sad. What have you been up to, Hannah?
Well, I'm going to give a serious answer and then a slightly ridiculous answer. So seriously, another podcast that I've been really into over the last year is The Shift, which is presented by journalist Sam Baker. And it's all about being a woman after 40. Interviews with fascinating women about their careers, about, a period of their kind of life, where often women are overlooked in terms of the public discourse. Really great series of guests, but I want to flag up the episode with Kit Duval, the working class novelist, absolutely fascinating on the kind of intersection of being working class and a woman and in a creative sector. Just really enjoyed that. And if you are interested, go and check that out. It's a great podcast. My ridiculous answer is, I'll be honest with you, I'm exhausted at the moment. I've got two kids. I've just moved house. It's a run up to Christmas. Terrible Christmas films. absolutely love them. And Netflix has got absolute bangers this year. So, you know, I'm sure somebody listening agrees with me there. Can't always be highbrow.
Well, I would love to listen to the shift. That sounds great. Gavin, how about you?
A couple of films. Two amazing German films, actually. One is All Quiet on the Western Front, which is absolutely stunning, moving and quite upsetting, but just a work of absolute genius. And the other one is called Stasi Comedy, a comedy about the Stasi. And the premise is that there's the dinner party in the new East Berlin, where a bunch of people who were resisting the DDR, the East German police and so on, are sitting around waiting because their dad is getting his Stasi files delivered so they can all go through it and find out what he was up to. And it's a hoot. That's all I would say. I didn't think I would ever laugh at the Stasi, but I laughed out loud. And it, very, very funny German film.
I really enjoy German comedy because it's, you know, we're so used to laughing at the Germans in British comedy. It's very good to actually hear German comedy for a change.
See, we do have a sense of humour.
Yeah, you absolutely do. I mean, my husband is half German, so there's a lot of German humour in our family. Nina, how about you?
I quite literally, also have two children that run up to Christmas. So my husband and I decided that we are going to do a date night. So we actually went to an escape room.
Oh my God, that's horrible.
I know. Yeah, we left our kids at home. We went to an escape room. Like, that's the kind of fun that a toddler and a baby means. But it was so fun. And we took the full 60 minutes to escape. It was only 3 out of 5 difficulty, apparently. But apparently they told us that the staff, who are obviously in full, they stay in character. They told us that you get escape room obsessives who crack that challenge in like 20 minutes. They just go from escape room to escape room. They're like, oh, this one's no good, Tom, you know, already done that one last week. So that was quite funny. And the other thing I've been doing is I've been listening to, I don't know how I came to this. I think I read an article about Edina Mountbatten and her numerous lovers. So I started listening to the audiobook written by her daughter, Pamela Hicks. And it is just insane how they would, again, being the mother of two very young children, age 3 and 1, how they would just kind of leave their kids with the nanny and then go off on respective, you know, adventures with their lovers across the world, return once a year. She's like, hello, darling, mummy's back. I was just like, explains a lot about Britain.
The neglect of the British upper classes towards their children is always something that, you know, I kind of half envy and half despise. Yeah. On the continuing the theme of Germany, I went to see a play called Good at the Harold Pinter Theatre, which has David Tennant starring in it. It's very good. It's basically about the moral compromises that a university professor in Germany makes during the 1930s to accommodate himself with Nazism. And it's when you see the current state of the Conservative Party, which of course is not Nazi, but there are, you know, definite similarities there. And on a lighter note, I love William Boyd as a novelist. He's just so much fun. I never understand why he's supposed to be literary fiction, because he's not really literary at all. He's just pure kind of pure excitement and fun and driving the narrative forward. But his latest novel, The Romantic, is a great read when you're trying to wind down from trying to finish your book, as I have been doing. And that's the end of the Tuesday edition of Oh God, What Now? Thanks to you for listening. We'll see you at the end of the week for another episode. Remember, if you want to help Oh God, What Now?, you can always back us on Patreon. You'll get the podcast early without adverts, exclusive merchandise, and a shout out on the show. So here's our theme tune, Demon is a Monster by Corner Shop, along with a thank you to some of our lovely backers.
Thank you from me to Quentin Neal, Jane McLaren, William Burke, Alex Jay, and Francesca Stefanato.
Hello and thank you to Chris Miles, Mark Bateman, Joe Caulfield, Caroline Herring, and Andrew Baines.
And for me, thanks for your support to Natasha, DJ Hanrade, Alison White, Will Barr, Barbara Coulson, and Thomas Sterling.
And finally, thank you from me to Alistair Keith, Susan Hoyle, Marjorie Bluer, David Norris, and Ben Roynan. See you on Friday.
Oh God, what now? Was presented by Ros Taylor, with Nina Schick, Gavin Esler, and Hannah Fern. The group editor was Andrew Harrison. The lead producer was Jacob Jarvis, with additional production from Jack Gerbertson, Kasia Tomashevich, and me, Alex Reese. The AI can take this edit from my cold, dead hands. Our marketing manager is Gina Richard, art direction by Mark Taylor. Oh God, What Now? Is a Podmasters production.